We turned on each other like animals. This is not over. This is still happening right now.
Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America Live?
The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized. They're made to seem either to be communist or some sort of disloyal person. A kook, there's a word, and now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff.
Tony, more than 30 people in Stephenville, Texas, say they saw a UFO. You believe them?
Tony Kornheiser, believe them. Who do you think was up there getting probed?
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. At the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And, of course, as you know, if you're a frequent BOA Audio listener, for the last month, no show. I've been away traveling. Went up to Vermont, spent a couple of weeks up there, loved it, had a fantastic time. And our guest, well, we're back now, of course, with the final 8 episodes of Season 8. And starting it off with a really big name and a good friend of mine and somebody who shockingly hasn't been on the show in over 4 years for a pure paranormal discussion. So I'm really looking forward to this one. He is, of course, the author of UFOs and the National Security State, Volume 1 and Volume 2, AD After Disclosure, which he co-wrote with Bryce Zabel, and the new book that just came out this past January, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. As I said in the description, he is a powerhouse UFO researcher and historian. Richard Dolan, welcome back to BOA Audio.
Hi, Tim. Wow, I had no idea it was that many years since I've been on. We did the baseball shows, but we hadn't done a paranormal or fringy type of political show in that many years. It's shocking.
I know. It's really, as I said before, it's kind of nice, though. Keeps it fresh, because it's been so long since we talked to you. We're probably not going to go over too much.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, as I get older and older, I'm 52 now. I just turned 52. And I realize, like, when you become old, like me now, 10 years feels like 1 year.
Yeah.
Like, when you're young, 1 year feels like 10 years. It's like, oh, my God, another year. I can't believe it. That's forever. But as you get older, you think, oh, 4 years, that feels like last week.
Hmm.
And honestly, it often does. I had no idea it was that long.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. I should double check, but I'm about 99% sure it's been 4 years.
You're probably right.
So now, as I said, I was doing a little traveling up to Vermont, but you were doing some extensive traveling over the last month. Tell me about this Canadian trip, because it sounds really remarkable.
Well, it was quite fascinating. This was organized by two men out of Toronto, Chris Rusak and David Whitehead, both who became very, very good friends of mine during the course of this trip. What they did is they organized a modern knowledge tour. That was the name of it. They based it around two primary speakers, myself and Michael Tellinger, who's South African and has done a lot of work on ancient archaeological sites down there, which are fascinating, and much more. So the two of us are basically the headliners, and then it was a 12-city tour from Halifax on the east coast to Vancouver out on the west coast, over 4,000 miles. And along the way, there were other guest speakers in various cities who accompanied us. And, some of them were very well-known people like Stanton Friedman, Linda Moulton Howe, Carrie Cassidy, and a number of other individuals who may not be quite as well-known in the alternative research field, but who are really excellent. Everything from GMOs to UFOs is how we were kind of putting it for a while. And yeah, it was a month-long trip in an RV, no less.
So, yeah, you know, that's the interesting part. So you were in the RV traveling across Canada.
That's correct, yeah. Yeah.
What was that like?
Many nights. So on some of the nicer evenings, I was able to get a motel. but for a lot of the time, it'd sleep right in the RV, sometimes while we were driving in the middle of the night trying to make our next gig in 9 a.m. And there were many nights. Honestly, it was taxing. It was nearly 4 weeks. that part. This wasn't like nice hotel, comfy, you know.
Right.
Nothing like that. It was demanding in that way. But on the other hand, it was fascinating, and I met so many brilliant, wonderful, fascinating people. That's the great thing about the travel is meeting people who have so much to teach you, and I can never say too much about that. That's very important for me.
Well, it's interesting. What were the folks who came out to these events like? What was really, you know, grinding their gears? What did they want to talk about? What was in their minds?
I don't think that Canadians have fundamentally different concerns about the big picture than what most Americans do. To be perfectly honest with you, you've got a certain number of people who are fascinated by UFO phenomenon, as you have in the United States. You have a certain number of people who are very worked up over globalization, elite Illuminati, Bilderberg, however you want to put that, that whole nexus. There's a lot of people interested in that. You have a lot of environmental issues going on. GMO issues have become very, very big in Canada as in the U.S. And I think, you know, as we move forward through these years, we're seeing that individuals who are interested in one of these issues are often very likely to be interested in other of comparable types of issues, whether it's 9/11, a lot of 9/11 researchers in Canada.
Really?
And on and yeah.
Weird.
Surprised. Quite a few who are very knowledgeable about this, and they come to the UFO lectures that I give. I would say that overall that the quality of the people is very comparable to everything I would see in the U.S. or in Europe, for that matter.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm surprised about the 9/11 part. Well, it's one thing. I've been dismayed because I got into this right after 9/11. I've been dismayed by how it's kind of – it was really hot there for a while, but now it's really – I just never really got over the hump, if you will, you know?
It does seem that it's kind of just died. It just kind of died. And I don't really think it has. I think – I mean, there's still very active 9/11 researchers out there.
Oh, yeah.
Who, obviously, but – it's certainly dead in any kind of mainstream kind of, you know, major media discussion. It's not there. But, of course, it was really never. It's never kind of been big. And you don't hear it on Fox News or CBS.
Right,
or whatever.
Right.
But I agree. I mean, we're 13 years now into this nightmare of this post-9/11 world that's, all but essentially come out as a kind of global police state, a U.S. police state. And that the justification for this, especially with the Edward Snowden revelations, you know, have really put an exclamation point on this, that people have no privacy. They have no privacy. And what is the justification for it? Well, the justification implicitly is 9/11, even if it's not stated openly. There are terrorists. They took down the Twin Towers. They did all of this. And even if that were true, even if it's like the grand conspiracy of Osama bin Laden and his ragtag guys from Al-Qaeda hiding out in his bungalow in Afghanistan, and they pull all this off. If you really want to believe that, all right, fine.
Right.
You want to go there. Even so, can anyone really believe that it's justifiable to create the U.S. surveillance state that has been created now? With NSA not only reading emails of so-called targeted individuals, and who qualifies as targeted, but as we've just learned, 90% of the people who have been observed by NSA are not even targeted individuals. And what's more, we learned through more of Edward Snowden's revelations that a lot of this concerns really private stuff, like people taking naked selfies of themselves or their girlfriend or boyfriend, or sex chat on Skype, or who knows what else. NSA is monitoring this.
They got all that stuff, folks.
Well, I'll guarantee you, there's NSA people there getting off on it, thinking, "Oh yeah, I got a great gig tonight. Let's see what this couple is up to again."
Yeah,
guaranteed. I mean, does anyone honestly doubt this? So this is what's become of the United States government. It is literally on par with the East German government of the 1980s and 70s, or the old Soviet state, in terms of surveillance. That is exactly what we have become. And what is the justification for it? 9/11, that is the justification. And that is, aside from being the fact that 9/11 is based on a fundamental lie, but even if one wants to accept it, what has happened since 9/11, none of that can be justified, even on the basis of the destruction of the World Trade Center and the attack on the Pentagon. This is totally disproportionate. It's obscene.
Well, it's a frightening world we live in nowadays. It feels like things are getting a little out of control.
It's frightening because we have a government police state.
Yeah.
That's making us frightened. I mean, when I see a cop, I grew up in a family of New York City cops. My dad was a police officer. He's a tough guy, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for those people. I went to police picnics. They used to let me play baseball with them when I was a kid. They were great guys. Today, I asked my father a year ago. He's in Florida now, and, you know, he's still around. And I said, hey, you know, is it me, Dad, or are cops just more likely to be assholes today than they were in your day? That's exactly what I said to him. He said, no, I think you're right. And when I see a cop today, I don't feel safe. I feel paranoid.
Right, yeah.
I don't feel safe when I see a police officer. I feel like they don't even exist for my public safety, honestly. They don't. What do they exist for? To take my money with speeding tickets and to basically, on the orders of their higher-ups, to lock up nonviolent offenders on bogus drug charges so that they can go to privatized prisons and make clothes for Target so it can say made in America so we can compete with China. A lot of America's industrial labor is prison labor.
Really?
Yeah, privatized prison. This is a huge scandal. This is an awful, awful thing. And this is our country.
Yeah.
And this is not supposed to be our country. And the only reason this can fly at all is because it's all under the radar. No one really, there's not a big public discussion on this stuff.
Well, yeah. I mean, they keep everyone distracted with bread and circus, as they say, you know.
Yeah.
So people just don't. Do you think someday, I was thinking about this, actually, when I was thinking about us talking here, especially kind of with the idea of this breakaway civilization. We'll kind of get into that in a minute, but
sure.
Do you think someday we'll, regardless of whatever happens, that we'll kind of like get out of this mess and look back and people will realize how obscene the world we're living in was?
Has to be. I cannot, and in fact, maybe this is an act of will. I will not believe that we're going to be in this situation forever. I just can't think it can be like this.
Hmm.
If there's one thing we can always know from human society is that we change, we evolve. Everything goes through changes. Nothing is stable, and we are in the most unstable period of human history that I can imagine. The amount of change we're going through is unrivaled by any prior history, period of history. So I can't think we're going to stay the same. Something is going to change. Now, whether it'll become a global surveillance state, a global police state in which everyone is basically under the boot, maybe that'll happen. But even that, I don't think, can happen forever.
Right.
But it may not happen. There may be a break. We are developing our own tools. We have a global communication system that's in place that did not exist 20 years ago. Yes, there are attempts by the U.S. government to turn the Internet into basically television through multiple-tiered service and all of that.
Hmm.
But it's, you know, end of net neutrality.
Right,
if that happens. But right now we've got a truly free Internet for the most part. And that's a tremendous tool for people. So I think, you know, we're able to share information in ways that were just not conceivable a generation ago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
It would never rule us out in terms of fighting the good fight and winning some points for freedom.
Mm, mm. Well, I was reading, I read Animal Farm while I was on vacation. And
oh, what a great book.
Oh, it's fantastic. And there was a couple of essays in the beginning by scholars or what have you about the book and sort of the time it was written. And one of them made an interesting point that it was, that Orwell and the other writers of the time, I think Huxley was one of them maybe that the guy mentioned, they envisioned a future that was obviously a lot like ours, but even more clamped down. And although the author kind of dismissed the idea that we're living in any kind of difficult world, I think the article was written maybe in the 80s. The point I guess I'm trying to make is what the author made is that the writers in question, I guess didn't take into account the human fallibility of people that want to take over the world. I guess is the point.
Yeah. Typical academic argument. Honestly, it's just so typical of the eggheads in academia. I used to hear this for years and years. Well, grand conspiracies can't happen because people screw up and they can't keep secrets and blah, blah, blah. You know what? That's why they call it the Ivory Tower. Because a lot of these people, they don't get out much. And I honestly think, I don't think they have a clue. Some of them do. But look where we are now. So in the 1980s, when this academician was writing about Orwell, yeah, I mean, I remember the 80s. I was a young guy. And there was, we were not living in a totalitarian state. No, by any means. But now fast forward another 30 years. And things are way more Orwellian than they were in 1985, 1984.
Yeah.
The real 1984. Vastly more. But we're still not a situation where... think about it. You know, in Orwell's 1984, so just switch over to that, the TV would watch you.
Right.
Or something would be monitoring. We have that.
Yeah.
It's not your TV. It's your webcam on your computer.
Mm.
And the NSA absolutely monitors people through their webcam, and we know this. This has been confirmed. So there's a thing right there. That's pretty darn scary. And in terms of having all of your communications, monitoring everything, lying, Ministry of Truth, reinventing, rewriting history. We see this all the time with whitewashing and spin. He who controls the past controls the future.
Mm.
And I really would suggest that we are in a vastly more Orwellian period than we were in the year 1984, the title of George Orwell's great book on the future. So it only just shows that, you know, it took a little longer for the world to catch up to Orwell's vision, or it just shows how far ahead Orwell really was in seeing it. And Huxley, too, by the way, with Brave New World. There's a lot of truth in Huxley's vision, which is actually, in a lot of ways, Huxley was more right on. I mean, Orwell's vision of the future was kind of like a Stalinism, you know, with high tech, essentially,
yeah.
And it's heavy-handed. Whereas Huxley, it's, you know, people are seduced by the New World Order, and they take drugs. They take this thing called Soma, which makes them very happy, and they accept their slavery. And that sounds a lot like, a lot of aspects of Western and modern society, for sure. And also the fact that, if I'm recalling Huxley correctly, people were sort of artificially engineered biologically. There were different types of people who would be suitable for different types of tasks. And we are getting very close to that capability through manipulation of the human genome. Does one honestly think it's impossible in another 20, 30, 50, 100 years for there to be truly custom-designed human beings, a master race, a slave race? That sounds crazy, but it's the capabilities absolutely are going to be there.
Yeah, it's spooky stuff. Now, I guess just speak up a little bit or move away from the fan.
All right, let me turn off. I got air conditioner on, so let's turn that thing off. There we go.
All right.
How's that?
That's great, because someone mentioned it in the chat, and I can already envision the email.
No, sorry about that.
It's all right.
I'll put my quiet fan on, and we'll be okay. It's kind of hot here.
It's getting hot here.
Up in the Northeast, but
it's a little rough, but
I'm glad they
mentioned it's the summertime. Hey, before you know it, we'll be complaining about snow. Don't worry.
Yes, indeed.
So this breakaway civilization, you first kind of mentioned it in UFOs National Security State Volume 2. I remember really coming away from that book with that, such a profound idea. And, of course, you've expanded on it and really sort of dug into it over the last few years. Talk a little bit, sort of set people up with this idea here so we can get into it.
Absolutely. What's been gratifying to me is that I hear a lot of other people talking about it. I hear it on Alex Jones's show. Of all places, it would be nice if Alex would have me on his show so I could talk to him about it. I think he's afraid of having a UFO researcher on his show. I actually think so. But the idea of a breakaway civilization, think of the black budget world on steroids with ET technology tossed in there, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, we know for sure that within the NSA, for instance, the NSA, which for the first more than 10 years of its existence was absolutely, totally secret. No one knew of the existence of the NSA. In fact, its nickname for NSA was No Such Agency. That the NSA during that period of time actually had the best computers in the world.
Oh, wow.
By the early 1960s, I know this because I had a long chat with a civilian scientist who was with the NSA in the 1960s. And he said circa 1964-65, the NSA had computers with clock speeds of 650 megahertz. Now, today, that's very slow. But that clock speed was not reached by the consumer market until the year 2000, so about 35 years later. NSA, you could say, was 35 years ahead of the rest of the world. And in 1965, I mean, there were no personal computers. So, and this was an agency that no one knew about. And that's pretty remarkable. So now, you know, keep that in mind. And now think of UFO phenomenon. Think of not just UFOs, but think of crash retrievals. This is still, to this day, at times a controversial subject among some researchers, but I think the evidence for crash retrievals of exotic technology is overwhelming. And if you go on that basis, that military groups, U.S. military in particular, have recovered technology that did not originate from our civilization. Let's just assume that for a moment. Mm-hmm. I think it's true. Now you have to assume, okay, they are studying it. And they're not just going to be sitting on their hands looking at it. They're going to try to replicate it, obviously. How do you replicate it? Well, you go through what we call black budget channels. That is, you create private funding for it, funding that Congress doesn't know about, that the people don't know about. And it goes through private contractors, obviously, and who becomes the owner of this technology, there's a good question for you. Is it the Army? Is it the Air Force? Is it Lockheed? Is it General Electric, right? Well, increasingly it becomes privatized. This is the way the black budget world does work. So let's take it further. So in that world, you've got these brilliant scientists, and they're tasked with understanding this exotic piece of technology, and they don't even necessarily know where it came from. They're just told to study the electromagnetic properties of this, or a way to achieve what might be called fiber optics, and on and on and on.
Hmm.
And so let's say they come up with some nifty ideas, and they create fiber optics, or they create high tensile fibers, or lasers, or what have you, or better integrated circuits, or who knows.
Yeah.
So that's a great thing, because that's a money maker, and everyone's happy, and they can feed the war machine and so forth. But what if they come up with ideas that are even better than that? Ideas that are like energy breakthroughs, so something that's better than petroleum. Because think about it. Even a 10-year-old child looking at the movement of a flying saucer across the sky, silent, instant acceleration, zigzagging, whatever, they're going to know that's not being fueled by fossil fuels.
Right.
That's not petroleum. Whatever the energy source is, it's better than that. So clearly, there is an energy, there is a new energy paradigm implicit in the UFO phenomenon. And if these scientists in the black budget world came up with that, if they figured it out ever, there is no way, not one chance, that they would be allowed simply to share that with the rest of the world. Because that would take down the petroleum industry, that would take down the entire financial structure that supports human civilization on planet Earth.
Right, right, right.
And replace it with something maybe better, probably better,
yeah,
but also
yeah.
out of control of those people who've got the control. So what happens to it? Well, these people would still be told, okay, well, we're not going to let this out, but you're going to continue to research it, and we're going to classify this research. So anyone in the outside world who stumbles into this, that's classified, and they're not going to be allowed. We will not let them. There are thousands and thousands of classified patents in the United States and elsewhere. And this is one of the key reasons. So what we in the black budget world would keep doing is we'd keep working our science, preventing the rest of the world from attaining that science because it wouldn't be allowed. Would we build our own flying saucers at some point? Could we? If we develop electrogravitics or new energy sources, is this really impossible? Well, there are leaks galore indicate this, and the logic indicates it, and I think that's exactly what's happened. So if they have a breakthrough in technology, that means they're able to go off-planet. That means they're able to have interactions maybe with other beings that ordinarily we wouldn't be able to have. It would mean that they have a different view of the world and of the universe and a different understanding of the place of human beings in the cosmos.
Hmm.
All of these things, I would suggest, are characteristic of a separate civilization, a civilization that's broken away from our own, hence a breakaway civilization,
yeah.
The core of the idea. Now, there's a lot that I don't know about these people. I'm not part of that civilization. They haven't let me into any of their club meetings, so I can't tell you. But I suspect that they're not necessarily all living on Mars in some alternative three setting. They're probably living here on Earth, which is, I suspect, where the real action is anyway. But they may be on Mars, for all I know. They may be on the backside of the moon. There's a lot of fascinating indications regarding the moon, as a matter of fact. This is something I just have been looking into again recently.
So with this breakaway civilization, though, are we talking about like the one percenters? Where are those, you know, that super rich?
Well, I think that's a great question because we have to understand the whole thing, and we've got to be able to piece the whole thing together. If it doesn't make sense, then there's something wrong with that picture. So I ask myself the same question. And what I think we are seeing is financially, we are seeing a breakaway civilization financially. Not sure, I think, when we mean one percenters. That's shorthand for the 1% of the 1% of the 1% at the
right.
top. I mean, the top 1% of wealth owners. If someone has $50 million, they can be my guest. I don't care. That means they have a nicer car and a nicer house than I do. Fine, let them. But when you're talking about someone who's got $50 billion,
yeah.
Now, that's a factor of 1,000, and that's serious power and serious wealth, and those are the people who control entire political systems and infrastructures. $50 million, honestly, that just means you're rich.
Right, right.
Be my guest. Be rich. I'm totally cool with that. $50 billion is a different order of magnitude, and those are the people, really, we have to look at in terms of what we're really managing or directing the course of the infrastructure of our world. And what we're seeing in terms of breakaway financial structure, we're seeing it happen before our eyes. And things like, well, it started years ago with NAFTA and the World Trade Organization and GATT, and now what we're seeing in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and we're seeing in what's called TAFTA, that is the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement. In other words, we're seeing it in all of these global treaties, economic treaties, that go beyond, that make basically parliaments and congresses irrelevant, where you're creating a global structure that's nailing down international copyright, international intellectual property, all kinds of trade laws, all kinds of control over natural resources. All of these are leaving the hands of the people who elect their representatives and are going into these international organizations and treaties which are beyond control, which are designed by the top 50-100 corporations in the world and which are really controlled by the very top few powerful people in the world. They're really creating a new legal system globally right before our very eyes, and no one's talking about it, in which they are literally breaking away from traditional sovereignty and ideas of sovereignty that people like to have. You know, I vote for my member of Congress and blah, blah, blah. Well, none of that really is applicable anymore. It's all going away. I liken the United States and really all countries to a dead body on the side of the road. So you're walking along the road, right, and you see this dead guy, and you, you know, you poke him with a stick, and you think, he's not moving. He's probably dead. But then you think, oh, but he's wearing the suit I saw on him last week. He's probably fine. The suit is our formal institution, the President, Congress, Supreme Court, the clothing. You know, it's like that movie Weekend at Bernie's. Remember Bernie?
Oh,
poor
yeah.
Bernie dies, and they have the party, and they trot him around, and put the sunglasses on him, and it's a great comedy. But that's actually, sadly, that in a lot of ways is our country. We have become Weekend at Bernie's in the sense that the body's dead. The clothing is still there, and what has actually taken over is a completely new body, and it goes unacknowledged. So I think, now back to the connection with the breakaway civilization, the radical technology and all of this, piecing some of this together, we know that when you look at what we call special access programs, black budget programs, that it appears that the dominant power in those programs is not like the U.S. Pentagon and the Department of Defense and those guys.
Mm-hmm.
They are increasingly seen as liaisons, and that the real power are the corporations that run them, like Lockheed, like Boeing, like Raytheon, like General Dynamics.
Yeah.
They're the guys in charge, and they are owned by whom? They're owned by the top 1% of the 1% of the 1%.
Mm-hmm.
So what it looks like to me is that this secret, in which the UFO phenomenon is also contained, is controlled by a privatized group, which is increasingly internationalized. And by the way, I had a conversation some years ago with a brilliant man, absolutely top-rate intellectual man who was with CIA for many years and used to give briefings to U.S. presidents on certain things. And it's kind of neat for me that I get to chat with him every so often. This is a man who, if I ask him a question, he'll qualify it five or six different ways before he gives me his precise, exact answer. He's very meticulous. And at one point, he said to me, this is a really telling thing, that after he retired, because he has a fascination with the UFO phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
a lot of knowledge of it, and he said, in my retirement, I have had conversations with 18 former, and then there's one of three positions, former presidents, CIA directors, or secretaries of defense.
Wow.
So 18 of those guys. These are the people at the top rung
mm-hmm.
of the American national security empire, basically, right?
Yeah, they have access to the button.
CIA, exactly. So he had conversations one-on-one with 18 of these people about UFO/ET. Imagine being a fly on that wall. So he said, the way that they discussed this with me fell into three basic categories. Category number one was maybe three or four of them said, essentially, UFOs, that's crazy. Don't waste your time with such nonsense. Category two was at the opposite end of the spectrum, and that was almost as many. It was like he said two or three. That's exactly what he said, two or three.
Mm-hmm.
He said, two or three said to me, oh, yes, I was briefed on that matter also. So they had some knowledge about it. He said, by far the largest group were people who said, oh, UFOs, I have been trying to get information about this, and I haven't gotten anything. What do you know? Maybe we can share information.
Oh, wow.
So now, right, so that what he was implying is that at the very top rung of the formal structure of power in the United States, most of those people are not briefed on this. Most of them are out of the loop. And there is a loop, but they're not in it. So then that prompted me to ask this man.
Who's in the loop?
Well, who's exactly? He said, well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? He said, look, I mean, I said, are we talking like the Bilderbergers? Are we talking private financial groups? He says, yes, that's what I assume. He wouldn't give me an exact answer.
Yeah.
He was very, very careful. I'm sure he knows a lot more than he was letting on to me. But what he strongly implied is that we're talking powerful interests behind the presidency. And, of course, anyone now who looks at the political system today, who's got half a brain in their head, they understand that the president is a figurehead. He's a puppet. Whether his name is Obama or Bush before him or Clinton before him or Bush before him or Reagan before him, they're all. These are people who are put in there. And they are literally, in some cases, actors, but they're pitchmen. That's what their job is.
Yeah.
So there's a power behind them, and that goes for the UFO phenomenon. So what we're talking about is the death. We're talking about the death of nation states, ultimately, in the form of the power that's behind the scenes. And that's very effective for them because, you know, for those people who really are trying to guide the world in the direction they want it to go, their attitude is nations are messy. Separate national laws are inconvenient. We need a global currency, in their opinion. We need, you know, kind of a unified direction for humanity. This is exactly what they want. I'm not saying I want it. I don't want that. But that's what they want.
Right, right.
And so if they're going to go through that, they realize it's a very unpopular position. So, of course, they're going to go about it quietly.
And slowly.
And if they control the major media, which, of course, they do, they're not going to promote it through that. If they manage most of the political actors in most countries, which they do, they're not going to have those people talk about it. So this, or the academic community, which is all tied into it. It's all tied into it.
Yeah.
So it's left to outsiders like you and me and other researchers who are outside of that matrix, who are trying to get the attention of the rest of the world saying, hey, look what's going on here. There's some serious developments going on, and we need to address them.
Well, it's scary, too, because, you know, I said the one percenters, and it's like you saw those protests. That's where the whole thing really kind of came from, the one percenter name. It's like
right.
It's the scary part, too, is even the general public is now just unrest about this divide of power and money. And it's like I was saying earlier, it's like, if we get out of this mess, maybe we'll look back and realize how, you know, how the people who lived in Germany during World War II didn't realize how crazy it was, kind
oh, yeah.
of thing. So it's scary that there's this unrest. It's like, even without some of these people are just angry that these people are so rich and the power to buy. They don't have any care about UFOs or secret technology or anything like that. So it's, this whole thing is like, feels like it's teetering.
I agree with you. The thing about the UFOs, a lot of people don't appreciate just why the UFO phenomenon is so significant. And I never tire of telling this to people because it's important.
Hmm.
When you talk about the black budget, you talk about theft of money. The UFO phenomenon is significant in all of this. It's not trivial. Go back again to the beginnings of the black budget culture that has really taken over the United States. Go back to the 1940s. Go back to Roswell. All right, so if you're Harry Truman and all of this new information is presented to you that, my goodness, we've recovered alien technology, you can't just tell the world. You have to create a program that's going to study this. That's going to cost money, a lot of money, actually. And you can't just tell Congress. So you must create a black budget. You must, in other words, create secret spending. And, of course, spending eventually becomes illegal through narco-trafficking and financial fraud and banking fraud and all of that, which they do. But but the UFO phenomenon is one of the key instigators of what has become this black budget empire. And not only that, people need to understand that because of the UFO phenomenon, our future is being held hostage.
Hmm.
What do I mean by that? I am talking about technological breakthroughs that are clearly evident in any UFO report you care to read. There is some technology that is all around us, and this is possible for human beings to have, but we are prevented from having it because you have a black budget world that has classified this, and we are not allowed to have it. So we are basically kept in this petroleum-dominated paradigm of financial control, which is all based on petroleum, which is one of the foundations for all of the wars that we have and all of the misery that we're feeling right now and all the toxicity and pollution and all the other awful things that are happening. I'm not saying that lifting the veil on the UFO secret is going to fix every problem we have. I certainly don't think that that's the case. I think human beings are problematic to begin with. But I do think that it would help us in many important ways.
I think it would break a logjam of sorts, an intellectual logjam that we're at right now.
That's what AD After Disclosure was really all about when I wrote that book with Bryce Sable. That was our adventure in exploring how the end of UFO secrecy really might liberate not just the human infrastructure but the human mind.
Right, right. And the funny part is it has very little to do with aliens when you think about it. It's really about the humans and their intense desire to keep the control over all the other humans.
I agree, although I try not to forget that there are these other beings that appear to be interacting with us here on Earth and interacting with maybe other life forms on Earth as well. They have an interest in Earth, and if I were an alien visiting Earth, I would have an interest in Earth. This is an incredible world. We've got an incredible abundance of a variety of DNA and different types of life forms and resources. I mean, it's exciting. This is Earth. We've got great things going on here. And then there's humanity. And often we tend to dismiss ourselves and dismiss our importance. But I think human beings are fascinating, and we might really be the best soap opera in this part of the galaxy, for all I know. They may be looking at us thinking, these humans are about to jump into the new level of development technologically, where they were just playing with wooden carts and horses and things like that. Now they're actually about to have advanced nanotech and advanced AI. They may be a real hassle. They may be an issue in the next 100 years. Of course, they're going to be looking at us.
Hmm.
So, I don't rule out that there has been manipulation by them. If I were an alien looking at humanity, I might think I'd want to get my people inserted into their infrastructure to make sure that I manage it the way I want. Hey?
That's an interesting idea.
What's to stop? We have this idea, a lot of people have this idea anyway, that advanced aliens who can travel through the stars must be peaceful because they would have destroyed themselves by now. I hear this all the time. I'm not persuaded. There is nothing inherently illogical about the idea of interstellar economic hitmen. You know, guys who go exploiting, like, what was that, the Borg on the old Star Trek series, you know?
Yeah.
Basically, cultures that are users. Why is that impossible? Why, if they have any kind of remnant of their biological heritage, then they might be predators, right? They might be, all life forms have to find a way to eat. They have an imperative.
Right, right. They're concerned with preserving their own species,
yeah.
Just like
so
humans are.
I think it'd be rather foolish to just throw that idea out a priori, thinking, oh, no, well, they must be peaceful. And one hears this all too frequently. So anyway, my point is simply, I agree with you. I think the human controllers of the secret are our greatest, probably our greatest immediate threat. And it may be that these other beings are generally peaceful. It may be. It's entirely possible. Or it may more likely be to me that they just don't really give a shit because they're just too far ahead,
right,
wherever they are, and humanity is maybe a small little, you know, barely noticeable. That's possible as well.
Hmm.
So that they may not be here to squash us. I don't know what their motives are. But, you know, they're a factor.
Hmm.
They are a factor.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, this is another issue that I've been sort of toying with lately. I talked about it toward the end of the year. When I was looking back on the past year, especially the citizen hearing on disclosure, it's,
yeah.
I think ufology, well, the UFO phenomenon itself has a problem, I think, because like the old commercial for the shampoo was, you know, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. I feel like the UFOs, they've made their first impression now, and now for those of us in the UFO community who are trying to educate people and sort of get them on board looking at the mystery, you have to overcome that difficult first impression where it seems like, that, as you were saying, the guy who talked to all those people, a lot of people would just dismiss it out of hand.
Yeah, right. What guy who talked to all those people?
Your friend there.
The CIA guy,
yeah.
right, exactly. A number of them did. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. We've got 50, 60, 70 years now of cultural baggage associated with this phenomenon. One thing that I've often wondered, I've asked myself this, is if, let's pretend that there was no UFO phenomenon or no noticeable phenomenon until this year, until 2014.
Okay.
Like, so there was, no one knew about Roswell, no one knew about flying saucers in the 1940s and 50s, and none of that existed. And then just pretend that someone switched on the UFO phenomenon to where it is today, right now. In other words, if you go online looking for UFO reports, you go to the major websites, the National UFO Reporting Network, the MUFON website, some of the Canadian sources. In 1 year, the total for North American UFO reports nowadays is up to 15,000 reports per year.
Wow.
No joke. 15,000. 15,000 UFO reports. I'm not saying they're all alien craft, clearly, but there's some of these are quite detailed.
Yeah, even if just like what 1% was
yeah.
an alien, that's still
so
like 150.
15,000 is about 40 a day, I think. So pretend that we have no phenomenon all these years, and that suddenly someone switches the lights on, and we're getting 15,000 of these reports a year. Imagine how that would, like, how would that affect our media and our worldview and our consciousness today? I wonder. Would it be dismissed? Would people be talking about it? Would people be assuming, oh, my God, did we create some radical technology? Are there aliens here? I mean, all of those questions would be asked.
Hmm.
And they would probably have seeped into the mainstream because it would be a new thing.
Yeah, the mainstream would love that.
They would, but then the question would be, where would they go with it? And I don't know. I don't know if it would be different today than it was in the 1940s. I know, it's just a thought.
I think it would be better, honestly. I think it would be better just because the media is so pervasive and all-enveloping that, you know, we had the old expression in Syracuse, you got to feed the goat. You know, you always got to come up with something new to put out there, and I think they would love it.
I don't know about the corporate media. I think the alternative media, guys like yourself, and I have a weekly radio show, I'd be talking about it. But I think, I don't know about NBC.
Yeah, I don't know, actually,
I'm not sure.
Because they'd want to keep it all a secret. So then it would be like this whole, we'd see sort of a replay of the 50s kind of attitude.
But yeah, but I mean, back in 1950, there were, roughly about up to 1,000 reports a year. The biggest year of reports for Project Blue Book back in those days was 1,500. That was in 1952. That was a huge year. There were many years where there were like 500 reports in the whole year. But you go from that, now we have 15,000? I mean, it's just a vast qualitative and quantitative jump. So it just seems to me, I'm only mentioning this little hypothetical just to get people thinking about how we've become sort of numbed to the year in, year out reality of UFO phenomenon. We've kind of like, we've forgotten about it.
Hmm.
But if it had just would be to turn on like right now, there'd be a lot of people getting worked up over it because it's going full steam every year. It does not let up.
Hmm. Well, how do you change? You're right about taking it for granted in a way, but how do you change that paradigm? How do you get people? How do you overcome all these years of cultural baggage? You know, it's
a question I've
struggled with. So, you know, I'm turning to you for help.
I'm doing what little I'm able to do. I write books. I talk to people. I try fearlessly to speak the truth as I understand it. That's what I try to do. I'm in the process of revamping my webpage, which I've not been happy with for several years. And by the end of the week, by the way, it's going to be very nice. So I'll do what I can do, but really what changes is that going to make in the larger culture? You know, 14 years ago when I published my very first book, the first volume of UFOs and the National Security State, I didn't really think that I was naive enough to think that I would that this book would break the secrecy. But I will admit, like, in the course of writing that book, I thought, maybe I'll get lucky. Maybe this will be the book that will crack the wall of secrecy and open it up. Because I wanted to create a book that was very meticulously researched, that was unarguable against it, you know.
Hmm.
And I think I did a reasonable job at that. But, of course, that didn't make a dent in the least in the culture of secrecy.
Yeah.
In our mainstream. I mean, not at all. It didn't even register, I think. So what would it take? Well, the good news is that we're in an era now of things like WikiLeaks, and we're in an era where people can grab digital data, whether legally or not is irrelevant, frankly. They can grab that digital data, and they can toss it out to the world and say, look at this, look at all this illegality. Whether it's Bradley Manning or Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden or researchers and journalists like Glenn Greenwald, there are many, many other people out there, whistleblowers. Those people are out there, and they are grabbing information, and they are putting it out there. This is a symptom of the new era in which we live. This is not an anomaly. This is the new reality, not going away. So where are we going to be in another 10 years, another 20 years with this? It's hard to predict, but I think that I would be surprised if we did not have an entire new slew of revelations that would maybe generate some real political change.
Regarding UFOs?
Yeah, regarding UFOs, for starters. Maybe even regarding 9/11.
Mm.
Maybe even something as seemingly mundane as the Kennedy assassination. That could be actually a quite revolutionary, radical thing if the truth on that were to come out in full.
Yeah. Well, do you think the UFO secret's so kept so secret that they don't actually have sort of the paper trail of sorts nowadays, or do you think it's out there? But
great question.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's an old quote from a former director of the CIA, Richard Helms. He ran the agency back in the 60s and 70s. And Richard Helms once said, the first rule in keeping secrets is nothing on paper.
Hmm.
And this is an old rule from the intelligence world, obviously. The paper trail, in many ways, has gone cold. We, in our nation, we were very lucky with the advent of the Freedom of Information Act, which is kind of gutted in a lot of ways these days for our purposes. But during the Jimmy Carter years, during the late 70s, thank you, President Carter, we had the vast majority of documents relating to UFOs that we have today came out during the Carter administration, if you can believe it. So that's great for Jimmy Carter, and that's really lousy for every subsequent president.
Yeah.
It's not that the spigot's been completely shut off, but it's been closed off a lot.
Mm.
And so what was once a nice little flow has become a trickle. So and now with everything being stored electronically, you're not getting a lot of these printed documents. It's very easy for electronic data to be kept out of the loop. And I spoke to a couple of like Washington insiders who know about classified documents, and one of them explained to me. He said, look, it's the easiest thing to keep a document impervious to a FOIA request rather than declassify it or have it available for declassification. You simply keep it in circulation as a kind of working document. And you can do this with, I mean, in other words, what he was explaining to me is that there were a variety of loopholes.
Hmm. So if it's like still in use, then it can't be, people can't get it.
Yeah, or in some manner or some fashion. Hmm. I have notes on this and I'll have to review them, but essentially that is what he was saying to me. And then the other thing about freedom of information, it's very difficult because, first of all, the FOIA desks are usually way undermanned to begin with. So if you put in a request in for the U.S. Navy for UFO data,
hmm.
All right, you can't just go to, like, the Secretary of the Navy and ask for every UFO document that they have. I mean, the Navy is just so big.
Right.
So you've got to be very, very – you have to go to a particular – department, maybe in the Office of Naval Intelligence, and you ask for specific UFO data. But even within ONI, there's a myriad numbers of offices and databases, and the person who gets the request might put out a request to like three or four of the people around him or her, and they'll say, hey, do you have anything on this? And they may get back to that person. They may not get back to that person. What I've come to learn is that this is a very haphazard system, and data gets squirreled away. There's not any, like, single, as far as I can tell, centralized engine that can generate data for Freedom of Information Act requests. So, like, when you're putting in, so in other words, what I'm saying is FOIA is essentially dead in the water, and it's essentially useless for UFO research and for a lot of other types of research as well. I'm not saying don't do it, but it's just don't expect it to be a magic bullet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it seems like we maybe have wrung all the water out of that we can.
I have no doubt that there is some seriously intriguing documentation left to be uncovered.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But whether we're going to get it legally, I think, is very questionable. Now, illegally is another matter. And in other words, through data dumps, through theft of digital files. I have a feeling that's going to continue because I think that's going to be very difficult to stop.
Right, right.
So, and I'm actually much more interested in that, and I think that's the future. We're talking about piracy. We're talking about individuals illegally breaking into data repositories, and I'm not condoning it or criticizing it one way or the other. I'm just saying this is the fact of life in the 21st century. It's not going to stop.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Snowden stuff, I mean, that was like a game changer in a lot of ways. It was really remarkable, especially for those of us who have been looking at this for years and years and years. I mean, your book's UFOs in the National Security State. It's like it must have been some kind of nice justification or vindication. There's the word I was looking for for you, yeah.
Snowden's in many ways, what Edward Snowden's data have revealed is actually not radically new from what many other people have been saying for years past. But what's fundamentally different, and this is important, is that this is actual NSA data that he's literally been able to get. So these are proven, genuine NSA documents that prove all of what these whistleblowers and claims have been saying for years.
Hmm.
And that is quite important.
Well, were you surprised at how we talk about how the media really probably doesn't want this getting out, the UFO secrets and stuff? Were you surprised that this story became so huge in the mainstream?
Yeah, but look at what they did with it. I mean, this is very interesting. The whole mainstream coverage of Snowden has been so infantile. It's like they treat us like we're five-year-old children, he's giving us baby food. Is Snowden a hero or a traitor? What is this narrative all about? It's just simplifying. In other words, the actual implications of what he is talking about have been very little discussed, in my opinion. And actually, I think there's even a deeper story to Snowden that is becoming more and more apparent, which is Edward Snowden has said he was CIA all the way. So what does that mean? That doesn't mean that he's deceptive, and that doesn't mean that what his data indicates is wrong, but it does mean that there are some kind of very interesting machinations going behind the scenes here.
Hmm.
How was it that Snowden was able just to go off to Hong Kong like that, right down the street from a CIA station office, by the way, if you remember? how was it that he was able to get himself to Moscow safely? Did the CIA help him?
Hmm.
My personal belief is that they probably did, and here's why. I think that very possibly within the CIA, you have elements who, you know, who believe that the NSA has been overreaching in their power. There's always been rivalries among U.S. intelligence agencies.
Yeah.
CIA, FBI, NSA, military intelligence, all of them. They're all fighting with each other in many ways.
Mm.
And CIA is prideful. You know, they like to think they're at the top. But here's NSA sprawling everywhere, going through everyone's emails. I mean, really un-American. I mean, you want to talk about traitors. Let's look at the NSA.
Yeah.
They're traitors to what the United States is about. And I really suspect that you got people in the CIA saying, you know what, this is wrong. We got our guy here. We're going to help him get some of this data out, and we're going to hustle him the hell out of the country. And I just wonder if that's part of the backstory of Edward Snowden. I don't know if we'll ever get that story officially, but he did state that he was a fully trained CIA operative.
Well, is it possible that the whole thing was done in sort of the old idea of revelation of method, maybe the CIA and the NSA aren't necessarily at odds, but just that they wanted people to know that they're being spied on?
Right, kind of a way of intimidating
hmm.
people, sounds what you're maybe implying.
Yeah.
Yeah. A couple of people have mentioned this to me as well. I'm not seeing that, but maybe. Maybe it's just a big mind job being perpetrated on people beyond their ability to fathom. You know, oh, yeah, they're reading every single thing you've ever written. It seems to me that they're very unhappy. I mean, unless they're just the best actors in the world. Maybe that's the case, too.
Oh, unhappy that it all got out.
Right. But
yeah.
I suspect that there's a real power play going on here. Certainly, when you listen to Snowden, the man is very eloquent, in my opinion. I think he sounds like he's for real. That's my take on him at this point, after all this time. I don't think he's a shill. I think he's genuine. And I think he has truly put himself at risk for doing what he's done.
Hmm.
And when I've listened to all of his interviews that he's given, and he's incredibly eloquent, it seems to me, and very thoughtful. So I don't think that's a game. I think that what he did is truly, I mean, that is technically illegal in the extreme, but thank God he did it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
it had to be done.
Exactly, it did have to be done. That's the, we need more people who are willing to break the whole system down in a non, you know, not blow things up. But
well,
just,
what we're seeing is that the U.S. Congress, U.S. Senate, Democrat, Republican, makes no difference. They are as criminal as the NSA, for the most part, in their complete subservience to everything the NSA is doing. I mean, there's been some criticisms of the NSA from Congress, but by and large, the vast majority of members of Congress aren't really saying boo about it.
Right. Plus, you wonder, too, given how loosey-goosey people are in this sort of Internet age, and if the NSA really has such tight surveillance on people, there's probably a lot of people that don't want to step out of line that could end up like Anthony Weiner or something, you know?
Well, absolutely. The whole point is to intimidate.
Mm.
It's all intimidation. If you know you're being surveilled, you know, let's say there's a protest against the next World Bank meeting or the, you know, WTO protests that, you know, come up every so often, or the G13 or G20 protests.
Mm.
Now we know that if you go to any of those protests, that you will be photographed, you will be video recorded. There's no question about this. And that the NSA, one of the revelations that came out is that they have incredible facial recognition software. So they'll find you, and they'll know who the hell you are, and they're going to know that you were at that rally. And that fact alone, that will intimidate many people. A lot of people are just, they're going to be afraid. And then they're going to be afraid knowing that their emails are being read if they get out of line. I cannot tell you how many individuals that I have met in my area of research, UFO, and I'm not talking about seasoned researchers, I mean like new people getting into the field.
Yeah.
And they're like little lambs. You know, the littlest thing is liable to get them afraid of being surveilled. I mean, people
yeah.
come up to me with this. I'm sure you've encountered this enough yourself. They have one little UFO story. I've heard thousands of them at this point. Another little UFO story is not going to get me excited. for the most part. But to these people, like, it's all cloak and dagger. They have to speak with me in a quiet area. They can't let anyone know.
Yeah,
they're
I know
afraid
exactly
the
what you mean, yeah.
So it's very easy for people to become intimidated, I find. And if they know that the NSA is monitoring their emails or video recording them at rallies, they, you know, a lot of people are just going to be cowed into submission, which I think is a big part of the point. Surveillance does intimidate people, and it destroys free societies.
The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized. They're made to seem either to be communists or some sort of disloyal person. A kook, there's a word. And now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff.